Hello, and welcome to the Regrettable Century. I'm Chris.
I'm Jason.
I'm Jenny.
And we have with us today Michael, who is a friend of the pod, calling from... Oh, wait, no, I probably want to say where you're from. It's probably top secret.
It's a bunker.
The bunker.
Bunker.
Calling from his top secret bunker in the frozen tundra. Say hi, Michael.
Hey.
All right, today we are going to be discussing what appears to be the dawning of a new age that has been foisted upon us all of a sudden by the advent of coronavirus, and what seems to be a perfect storm of some old ideas being reasserted into the public discourse in the form of some kind of social democracy, and a complete economic collapse that was going to happen anyway, but just happened to be touched off by a global pandemic. So we've got a big subject to dig into.
It's a big honking subject.
Well, okay. So, I mean, just to get us started, I think that trying to get an idea of what we think the prospects for the remainder of this primary season look like. I mean, I don't want to dwell too much on what may or may not happen, because it's, I think we could all probably just admit right now that it's impossible to tell what the fuck is going to happen on a day-to-day basis.
Yeah, well, we know that everything's going to be fine by Easter. So.
Oh, yeah, that's true.
We'll all make it a mess.
It's like we gave up the economy for Lent.
I don't mind that.
I'm starting to feel like a bit of a kind of like... mid-century, that's the wrong term. I like a
middle
a reformer in the, like, I'm feeling like a middle schooler. No, like a reformer in the Middle Ages. I'm prepared to give it up for longer than Lent.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
it might actually be the economy. It might actually be one of those things we have to give up forever.
Yeah,
I'm okay with
I
that.
I just don't believe in it.
Yeah. It doesn't exist.
It's not canon. It's not in the original scriptures.
Well, I mean, part of this whole thing is just, like, seeing how much of it is, like, basically made up. You know, it's just the Federal Reserve, like, minting the $1 trillion coins or whatever. It's just, like, you're just making this up as you go along. It's, like, it's just fake. Like, you can just, like, it's like, oh, we need more liquidity. Someone mint a $1 trillion coin, please. It's done. It's like, and then the markets are like, oh, hell yeah. We're going back up now. Line goes up.
I
want to steal that shit.
We talked about this on the episode about law and like how laws are created. And it really is just like when you're playing a board game with a kid who just decides to change the rules every 5 seconds and is like, I win. And you're like, but why? Well, because...
It's Calvin Ball.
Yeah, in a crisis, shit goes totally Calvin Ball. Absolutely.
Yeah, absolutely.
And the economy what is I just really like that.
What I really like about the MMT asserting itself in financial discourse is it also helps make a point that I like to try to make in conversations about our political moment more generally, which is how we don't really have that deep of a bench in terms of secondary leadership. And it's sad to say, but it's like Rashida Tlaib is one of the people who's like, we should mint $1 trillion coins. I'm like, oh, fuck. It's a good thing we have this new generation of radical leaders to help point our way out of the crisis. I was floored by that. It's like, fuck, why not three? Who's bold enough to propose three?
Yeah. So I think that the next layer of leadership is yet to reveal itself and will probably be forged in the flames of all of this fucking chaos that's happening right now.
Yeah, the next layer of leadership right now is out there spray painting rent strike on a mattress leaning up against a fence somewhere.
Yeah, and then once the people that are like bold enough to actually spray paint it on the fence come along, then we'll have some leadership.
That's right.
Yeah, but we've got a very shallow bench. We've got a weird kind of, I mean, okay. So I remember in 2016, right after the presidential election, Jason and I, we were having these conversations like, so what I've learned about politics over the past year is I don't have any fucking clue what anything means and I have no ability to predict what's going to happen. Like, and neither does anybody else. And people that say, oh, I knew this was going to happen the whole time, they're totally full of shit. But like, I'm not a very optimistic person. In fact, I think I'm probably the most pessimistic of our whole crew.
I can vouch for that.
And especially when it came to Bernie Sanders' prospects. But even what happened leading up to the moment that we're at right now was my pessimism didn't prepare me for how bad Bernie got screwed. And I kept saying, like, yeah, they're gonna figure out a way to cheat him. They'll probably do it at the convention. I didn't think that they would do it, like, you know, the third round of primaries. And I couldn't have foreseen that happening. So, and I could not have foreseen now, of course, a global downturn, a global pandemic, and at the same time, credible rape allegations coming out against Joe Biden, which I didn't think anyone was going to pick up. I thought the mainstream media was just going to ignore it, but HuffPo picked it up, Newsweek picked it up, and it's only a matter of time until, like, New York Times has to say something about it, you know?
Yeah.
So this is going to become a mainstream story now. And, of course, the Blue Dog Democrats, they still defend Bill Clinton. They're not going to give a shit about Joe Biden raping someone. They're just going to say that it's Russians that are promoting it.
Yeah. Well, what they're pushing now is that The Intercept broke the story, and so we can't trust Glenn Greenwald. And so it's not credible, which is both. It's not true. But
The Intercept didn't break the story.
The Intercept journalist that did write the article that they're referencing is also the one who wrote the article on Blasey Ford. So,
they're doing like a weird ass reverse Scottsboro Boys defense. Yeah. You know, which was a black man can't get a fair trial in Alabama. Mm-hmm. But it's in this case, it's in defense of one of the most powerful, most difficult type of people to assail, which is like a person who won't ever face a trial.
It's interesting that it was a combination of Elizabeth Warren and Joe Biden. They teamed up to beat the shit out of and completely put in the grave the Me Too movement. So that's over.
Well, they were done with it. They didn't need it anymore.
They didn't. It wasn't useful for beating down Bernie. And
they already believed the women that served their interest, so we don't ever have to believe women again.
We did believe women was the thing we were supposed to do, and we did it, and now it's over.
And now we can go back to not. And you know, I've always been. We don't have time to flesh that out on this episode, but I've always been critical of that as a slogan. Just because I think there are a host of problems that and contradictions that come with it, and I think they're revealing themselves.
Right.
But, you know.
Like, what do you mean? It didn't just mean believe women anytime they say anything?
Yeah, yeah, but, you know, it's really, really sad, actually, even with all of my, like, pessimism in tow, to still see things playing out this way right now.
I don't know what it means that the mainstream press are going to have to pick this up. Chrissy said that Blue Dog Democrats still defend Clinton to the hilt. So do all the rest of the liberals, basically.
Yeah.
I mean, the guy's just gotten a full pass. Put it this way. There's a good chance that the mainstream media breaking this story finally into the sort of popular kind of like information that's available, if it's on the New York Times, if it's on the Washington Post, if the networks are talking about it, it could still just have no effect.
That's true. It could have some effect too, though.
Yeah, it could have some. It could have none. It's like
who fucking knows?
Like the combination of like the propensity now towards like liberal conspiratorialism around Russia could have an effect. Kind of intense lesser evilism around trying to beat Trump could have an effect where people just say like, yeah, maybe he did it, but like, I literally don't care.
Yeah.
Because Trump has to be defeated either way.
He has fewer rape allegations than Trump.
Yeah. Yeah.
So I guess he's the lesser evil.
It's literally the fewer evil at least.
Yeah.
So it's like, it's just so, I mean, it's like you said, it's just so hard to read what's going to happen with this shit. My money is on like these allegations actually, like, I think Biden gets it passed. I mean, if I had to predict, I think Biden gets it passed. I'm not hopeful that this acts as a drag on Biden much at all. I think that there's a greater chance that like Biden actually just is like in a coma before the convention.
I think Fox News is holding it in their arsenal until the general election, though, for sure. Because conservative media has been awfully silent, and they were one of the first people to blast those videos of Biden just being a creep publicly. You know,
well, they don't want Bernie to get any more momentum.
I mean, that's precisely the reason why. So I think that they're going to hold that real close until, you know, it benefits them.
There's always the outside chance that the whatever afflicts Joe Biden's brain will eventually cause him to drop out of the race and endorse Bernie Sanders. But at this point, his endorsement might hurt.
Yeah.
Yeah. He may also make no endorsement. I mean, he might just disappear.
That would be ideal, because then at the live stream only, online DNC, it would just be Bernie Sanders versus whoever the superdelegate candidate is, which is,
Andrew Cuomo.
And either way, it will really severely damage the Democratic Party for a long time to come, which, it's worth cheering for.
Yeah.
So that being said, Andrew Cuomo does look like somebody that they might try to put forward. And the fact that Democrats are already like lining up to support him is another kind of, I don't want to say scary, just more dumb than anything else. Like, Democrats, I mean, liberals have to be the least principled people on the face of the planet. I can respect conservatives because they tend to be dyed in the wool with their beliefs, and they'll stand by them no matter what. In the face of like facts, in the face of anything else, they believe what they believe and they're unwilling to be budged from it. Liberals, however, don't actually fucking believe anything.
The entire party is like premised upon the belief that we have to respect everyone else's point of view, which is just not fucking true. Are people entitled to their wrong ass and harmful ass opinions? Yes. Do we need to respect and compromise with them? No. And that's something that the right wing understands very well, and we've talked about this several times, and that's why they're winning, you know? Because they say, well, we think abortion is wrong. We think it's murder. And we're not going to budge from that position. And then we meet them where they're at. And then Trump becomes president.
Anyway, I don't want to talk too much about the particulars of the political landscape right now. I'd like to try to move into a little bit more of a, like a macrocosmic view of the political situation, looking into the future and what we think that this new era might mean for not just our politics in the United States, but for the world. Because one of the things that has to be taken into consideration is that the stranglehold of neoliberalism on the ideology and on the discourse, on the global status quo has been broken in an instant by this crisis. So now all of a sudden, you know, Boris Johnson is implementing Jeremy Corbyn plans, and the right wing of the Republican Party is all for Keynesianism. Sure. And you know, all of the European Union countries that have been slowly slashing their social safety nets and gearing up towards moving into a fully like United States style neoliberal economy have backtracked on all of that and are providing 80%, like, I guess Denmark is providing, Denmark, Sweden, like Switzerland, France, they're all providing some sort of like either full or like majority
70 to 90%,
compensation for people's paychecks that have been laid off of, as a result of this. And that is some hardcore social democratic style programs that are being enacted. And, they're being enacted in a lot of cases by right-wing neoliberal regimes.
Well, I was going to say the Macron administration, you know, which fended off like a left populist nationalist in the form of Mélenchon, and then a right populist nationalist in the form of Le Pen, you know, and Macron, who kind of stands to you know, for the political consensus of the Clinton and Blair, that kind of not even third way, really, even more so, like, you know, he was the Hillary Clinton candidate in the French election. Mm-hmm. Now his administration is moving to subsidize like the entire French economy.
Right.
Actually, I was thinking in terms of like a bridge from the particulars of the American political moment to the broader picture of the world. I was thinking about the continued relevance of the Bernie Sanders campaign.
Right.
Because, you know, when you're just talking about the elections and the fact that the primaries are either delayed or are a scandal, right? They either should not be happening or they're not. Those are the two options here. And all of the stuff that we've talked about already with Biden and Cuomo and how worthless the Democrats are. If that's your only lens to look at the world, there's an argument to be made, and I don't share it, right? But that some people say, Sanders should basically drop out. This campaign's over. But he's basically campaigning at this point, and quite effectively, for policy, mm-hmm. even though it is less and less likely that it could possibly be in his hands as an executive, you know. So there's all these articles in the various like bourgeois financial press, both about, especially about Corbyn and Sanders as two people who represent the need or represent this moment best in terms of a vision, and that mm-hmm. their vision's being carried out by the people who defeated them politically. Which I think is that's a remarkable kind of admission. And it makes me wonder, like, what are the political consequences for people like us? What are the conclusions we can draw from something like that, where it's like absent a vehicle in the form of like a leadership or in the form of organization or movement or anything? It's in a moment of absence of these mechanisms by which we can actually like influence the world. The things are shifting in this transitional way at the basis of like statecraft and policy, you know,
mm-hmm.
that some kind of like Keynesian state capitalism is being demanded by history and circumstance, even in the absence of a real architect for it, you know. I think it's a bizarre phenomenon.
Well, I think that we have, as the crisis deepens, we've got two paths. One is for whatever exists of this sort of nascent left-wing stirring in the United States can start to insert itself into the conversation and try to drive things in the direction that we would like to see them go. And I know that the left is going to try to do that and is already currently in the process of trying to do that. And it can either be successful in trying to take control of the narrative over what happens, like the Keynesian sort of, you know, reforms, sort of stopgap measures to try to like the tourniquets to stop the hemorrhaging. Or they can be taken over by, you know, the mainstream political process, being the Democrat and the Republican Party, in which the Democrats will inevitably bungle and, you know, mealy-mouth their way into losing out to the Republicans, who will take over the process fully. And then we'll have Keynesian measures being taken by someone like Tom Cotton or like, you know, Josh Hawley at the helm of this new populist rightist regime that is using the state in order to help people. And that to me is like the darkest possible outcome.
Yeah, you mean like a kind of Peronist turn in American politics?
Yeah.
Yeah, I've been using the term Herrenbuch social democracy or Herrenbuch welfare state.
That's good.
But, I mean, yeah, it's like there's this moment. I mean, Jason, I'm thinking about your point, and it's just like what the left has had really up until this moment is not a serious vehicle, not organization, and not even the sort of like the benefit of having related or ancillary organizations with which it could relate, which are also all weak, thinking in terms of the labor movement and so on. The left has been successful mainly in sentiment and in getting sentiment, and in some cases in being able to sort of leverage that sentiment into some electoral successes in the form of Bernie's campaign and a few other electoral campaigns, which have been really sort of where the, you know, it's where all the action's been for the left, for the, since 2015, more or less. And it's just the total sort of accident of this random, basically random event. It's not exactly, you know, the timing is random.
Yeah.
Capitalism will produce pandemics like this. The timing is random. And the timing is so it's produced this crisis at a time when there's this sort of, high water mark of left wing sentiment. At the same time, it's a genuine crisis in the sense it's not just a, it's not just an increase in hardship for working people or for ordinary people. It's a genuine crisis in the sense that the elites have like lost their way. They don't know the way forward. They can't go on in the old way. And there's real disagreement and confusion mm-hmm. among them about how to proceed. It's tempting, I think, for me anyway, it's tempting to talk about this moment as a kind of a moment of a real sort of tension or contradiction, if you like, between the imperatives of capitalism on the one hand and its conditions of reproduction, your sort of classic Marxist contradiction. Those conditions in part being the public health of the population responsible for the creation of surplus value, right? And so elites face this choice, and it's playing out in the United States anyway in this really stark way where it was, you know, we were about a week into quarantine and chill before, like, the right wing was just like, I would sooner die than allow the economy to stop or whatever. You had, Dan Patrick from Texas being like, and the Wall Street Journal editorial board.
Yeah, we don't claim that guy.
Right. Wall Street Journal editorial board basically being like, look, this quarantine, you know, the cure is worse than the disease. The president saying the cure is worse than the disease. But elites are not of one voice on that matter.
Yeah.
Because some realize that the alternative, right, to shutting down the economy, basically, on a temporary basis, the alternative is that this pandemic really just rips through the population. And then you have real shortages, not based on quarantine, but based on illness and fucking death.
Like labor shortage is the basis of the other shortage.
Yeah, yeah.
Demographic die-off.
And die-off in crucial industries. It's because mm-hmm. it's not gonna leave anybody untouched. And so it's like, it's tempting to think about this as it's an actual contradiction. It's an actual dilemma. Elites cannot get themselves organized on a way out of it. But then it's like, on the other hand, it's like you kind of look, I don't know if this is an American phenomenon or a general one. You look to we were just talking about the Nordic states. They actually just have implemented policies right away where they're just like, okay, well, we're actually going to cover people. We're going to cover people's incomes through the duration. We're actually going to shut stuff down. Of course, that can't go on indefinitely, but the pandemic won't go on indefinitely. It will end. And so it's like, I've been trying to make sense.
This one will.
This one will. And then, you know, there will be others. And hopefully this whole, this is one of the questions, right? Whether or not we end up more prepared more prepared for subsequent pandemics.
I'm not hopeful.
No, that's up in the air, right? But in the United States, right, it's like you do have this drawing of the lines in a funny way where it's on the one hand, you have sections of both political parties arguing that we have to adopt, relatively speaking, radical solutions. The sort of left wing of the Democratic Party and the kind of, Trumpish populist wing of the Republican Party, offering relatively similar kinds of solutions economically. Tom Cotton calling for, basic income or whatever, this type of shit. On the one hand, and then the segments again of both parties who are more aligned with the kind of immediate interests of capital. This is a big reason that the Democratic Party, by the way, is so untrustworthy, obviously, is that
right.
It's they don't want to alienate their donor base. They themselves, when you think about who the Democratic Party is, like who are its personnel, these are people who depend first and foremost for their own livelihoods on the integrity of the party organization, and the integrity of the party organization depends on maintaining the connection to capital and its donor base. And these people represent a barrier as much as the Republican Party does to a solution out of this crisis. But no one's got any answers. So it is this kind of moment where it's like left sentiment, even unorganized left sentiment, can kind of have this like outsized role. And it's just, it has just sort of fallen into our laps, right? It's like we didn't do anything. It's just happening to us in the way it's happening to everybody.
So I think what's scariest to me about this moment is that the Republicans right now are building trust. And I'm just trying to keep my finger on the pulse of the people around me, on the pulse of like mainstream news, where in this moment, at least the optics are that the Republicans are giving people free money. And since that is so unprecedented for the most part, and people are in real financial distress right now, that feels like a lot, even though we know that it's not, and $1,200 is not one time, you know, and under these circumstances is not, gonna do it, right? We know that, but folks are responding very well to that. And when again, the optics are that the Democrats are the ones who held up that process, delayed that process.
Proposed a $500 counter to the $1,200
Exactly. Offer. Exactly. You know.
Fucking idiots. And,
listen, you know, that's very scary right now. And the Republicans are going to do what they have to do to save face in this moment. What I am scared of is in the aftermath of this crisis, what that looks like. You know, and we know that Mike Pence, for instance, is one of the architects of post-Katrina disaster capitalism. We know that he was the chair of the Heritage Foundation's free market solutions post-Katrina shindig, in which they proposed getting rid of a host of labor rights, opening nature preserves for drilling, privatizing schools. And we saw what the aftermath of that looked like. And so it is scary to me that in this moment, they are building trust. And despite all of the realities that we know about Trump, this administration, the Republican Party, and the Democratic Party alike, that in the aftermath of this, they're really going to push hard on their agenda.
Hey everybody, Chris here. Just wanted to remind you guys of a couple of things. First of all, we have a Patreon, and if you like listening to us and think we deserve $2 a month of your hard-earned money, please go and sign up. Right now, our patrons get access to irregularly posted content that includes special episodes, where we do deep dives into stuff that might be too nerdy for our main feed, extra content from episodes that go way longer than we expected, and impromptu discussions of events and articles that we think are worth a bit of attention. The second thing I wanted to remind everyone of is that we are now part of the Lost Horizons Network, which is a dialectical pessimist podcasting network that includes us, The Regrettable Century, Red Library, and From 78. You can listen to us, Red Library, and From 78 using your favorite podcatching app, or find us by searching our respective names on Twitter and Facebook. We also have a special Lost Horizons Network collaboration podcast, which is a roundtable discussion including members of all three podcasts. Our network website can be found at losthorizonsnetwork.com, which will be linked in the show notes. Our roundtable discussions will be available to listen on your favorite podcatching app, and also look out for us on social media. Just search for the Lost Horizons Network. And as always, please remember to subscribe, rate, and review us on iTunes. Those ratings and reviews help trick the algorithm into thinking that we are important and have something interesting to say. All right, back to the show.
The latest Salvage editorial, you know, I think draws out this question in a really good way, where, you know, on the one hand, you know, we have the emergence, like sort of nascent state capitalism merged with the security state in the era of big data, you know, with potentially ruinous consequences for the like democracies on life support that, you know, govern the majority of the capitalist world. And that, you know, they strike a somewhat hopeful tone when they say that, you know, maybe throughout the existing kind of mutual aid networks that are popping up and the various forums that people are starting to construct to, you know, get, kind of give some voice and attempt some coherence politically in this moment, that out of that might rise, hopefully, they're saying, hopefully, a rival source of public authority, a party that's more than a party, I think they call it, a demonstrable counterpower. Mm-hmm. In a place like the United Kingdom, that's a little bit easier, I think, just immediately to conceptualize, because you have
proportional, you know, representation.
Well, yeah, that too. But also just in a non-conventional way, you have you know, other forms of power, other sources of power in the form of, like, let's say a less broken trade union tradition, even though theirs has also been, you know, there's pretty good documentation about the long decline of British labor being linked to the long decline of British labor, right?
Mm-hmm.
But to whatever problems that you can point to in terms of, like, British unions, the Labour Party, their unconventional left in the form of, like, whatever came out of the Socialist Workers' Party and all of that, you know?
All the nanosects that came out of the microsect?
All of the various, you know, the sort of rhizomatic potential resistance that exists in the UK that, you know, could in some ways amalgamate into a new counterpower, they're just so much less clear to us here in the States. Like, however much of a psychological blow Corbyn's defeat was to an already scattered and historically weakened British left, and I think even the left is too narrow a conception. Let's say to any notion of popular sovereignty that exists in, or let's say any sense of the popular in British society. It's just so much more the case in this country when our basis is just so much flimsier. Like, let's say I share this hope, you know, Jenny, as you said, the Republican Party is building trust, you know, at a time when the Democratic Party is actually presenting itself as the greater obstacle, if only because, like, the severance package they're writing you, at least the Republicans are their severance package. Because it's barely a bailout and it's barely a social program. It's a severance package. Here's a $1,200
check. It's mostly a slush fund for the fucking mega corporations and ultra rich being just handed to them, with some table scraps being pushed over the edge into the dirt for us.
Yeah. I mean,
it's enough to keep you in your apartment.
It's a stimulus package
for
landlords because it's people's fucking rent, maybe, if they're lucky, you know.
It's enough that even if your rent is high, it's enough that combined with what you might already still have or might be able to scrape together, it's enough to keep you in your apartment for one more month until all the rent the eviction moratoriums are removed. Yeah. You can be evicted, you know, in May or in June.
It's spreading out the evictions is what it's doing, so that they don't all happen at once.
But yeah, so as to not further exacerbate the crisis that, you know, will accrue in, you know, in that particular sector. But all that is to say that, like, yeah, just to return to that point, that the what exists in what is available and even what is conceivable as the embryo of demonstrable counterpower in the United States is just, it's so much harder to see. And let's say it's troubling.
I mean, on the other hand, right. What's conceivable is now subject to change so rapidly. Right.
Good point.
Already it's like, I think we can't even measure, just because it's all happening so quickly and there's so little resources devoted to keeping an eye on this sort of thing. Yeah. But, there's, walkouts, wildcat strikes, less decisive or less dramatic kinds of resistance happening across workplaces, all over the place, and it's just impossible to keep track of.
Because it's so decentralized.
It's so decentralized. It's happening. Jason used the term rhizomatic. It's happening in that kind of way. It's just people's response to an absolute fucking crisis. And so for some workers, it's a matter of being classified as essential if they're going to be kept at work, you know, in grocery stores, right? The state needs to define them as an essential worker, and as a, and someone who's therefore, subject to certain kinds of regulations, benefits, and protections that ordinary workers aren't, right? So that's happened in Minnesota, Vermont, and, one or two other states. In some cases, it's workers struggling to be recognized as non-essential so they can go the fuck home rather than continuing to, like, I know one guy here who works at a printing press, and they mostly print, like, fucking coupon books, like junk mail, you know. And because they've because they had a relationship to the United States Postal Service, that he's been classified as an essential worker. Well, he does... rejects that classification, right? And there's a struggle there and a bunch of other places in Madison to be classified as non-essential so that people can quarantine. There are struggles over hazard pay, struggles over paid time off, struggles over access to PPE, all this shit popping off everywhere. People are learning lessons, I think, really quickly. And it's like, we can't even, you know, who knows how this shit will look in 2 weeks. The stuff over rent, right? Without any real... rent abatement or rent moratorium, for that matter, mortgage moratorium. It's like you don't even really have to, in a lot of ways, you don't even really have to organize rent strikes very well, thank God, because we're not in a position to, we don't have like serious tenants unions and so on. People are just not going to have the money. The rent's just not going to get paid come June, right? Or come July. It's like once that $1,200 evaporates, the rent's just not going to get paid. That crisis is coming, whether or not anybody wants it to. And so it's like, you know, what is conceivable now, you know, what's versus what's conceivable in 2 weeks or a month's time. Who the fuck knows? Again, I hold out some hope that that goes in the right way in terms of the forces of the left, such as they are, can quickly grow, benefit from, these crises, have the sort of like, at least skeleton of an infrastructure that can absorb people into some kind of organization, however loose or decentralized and so on, that we at least win again on some of those sentiment fights that were preventing people from being organized into a right-wing project, and that, like, a lot of these local struggles turn into victories. But yeah, I think, you know, I think that's definitely not out of the question. And I think for the, you know, on the Republican Party side, I think it is worrying how they've been successful so far in building trust and putting themselves forward as a solution to this crisis. But they're only doing so in a totally stumbly, like, really hesitant way. And, you know, it's like Trump couldn't have asked for a better ticket to reelection than this crisis and being the person to lead the way out of it. But he's like, almost in a way, he's committed to fucking it up. Like this, like, like everybody back.
His 4-year-old brain won't let him capitalize.
He can't just become smarter because there's a crisis, Michael.
It just won't let him. It's just like this everybody back to work by Easter shit. Yeah. This, like, you know, like the Republicans in the Senate who were like, we can't give people $600 extra a week for unemployment. That's more than they make when they're at work. And then what's going to happen? Like, they'll get used to being paid more. Like, we can't allow that. It's like, well, that's just not a winning message. so it's like, you know, it's like there's again, a lot's unwritten here. It's like the Republicans are certainly in a position to capitalize on this crisis a lot. It may be the case that they just fucking can't. They just, like, politically are not ready for it either.
So my Leninist brain kicks in when I hear all this stuff being talked about. And I can't help but visualize all these decentralized sort of efforts as just a bunch of steam dissipating off into nothingness, you know, and that whole Trotsky idea of the piston box comes into the need for it becomes clear. And I don't know what that piston box looks like in the United States. I know my Leninist brain tells me that it's the Workers' Party, right? But what the fuck is the Workers' Party? Where could it come from? What would that even look like? I'm not saying that I don't think that people should be fighting where they can, because if nothing else, this is most pessimistic prediction, is that some people will be further radicalized by their struggles. You know, not all of them. some of them are just going to fucking become Democrats and think, well, I guess I tried this decentralized resistance thing and it doesn't work. So what that really means is that you just got to vote blue no matter who.
Well,
which,
you know what
I don't
else?
Know if you guys remember Occupy, but that's what came out of the fucking other end of that.
Yeah. Well, and this is a very demoralizing moment compared to Occupy. So I think another thing that is like worth keeping in our minds is that what's going to happen with a lot of people is that they'll be part of the new statistics for a spike in the suicide rate.
Yeah.
Like, yes. That's actually what's at stake whenever we think about how we envision next steps. Is you know, we don't ever want to do the liberal thing and say don't ask too much because it's not possible. But neither do we want to just say like, well, crisis equals opportunity equals struggle equals class consciousness equals victory, right?
And when we fight, we win.
Right. Sometimes when we fight, we get ground into meal to be fed to the prisoners that got captured.
Yeah.
But
sometimes
when
we fight, we turn into Soylent Green.
On the other hand, though, I think it is like it's, you know, I don't know how many hands, but this is like a Goro from Mortal Kombat. There's six hands here. So on another one of the hands.
Yeah.
This moment and the fact that there seems to be a general at least shift in discussion toward relief, toward recognition of working life as such, you know, that there's a lot less discussion about like consumer demand and a lot more about like people as renters, people as workers, people as, single parents, you know, there's a deepening of the discussion about class and disparity between, you know, how some people will be fine and some people are being thrown, left out in the cold. So there's a way in which this moment gives a new meaning to the old situationist slogan that our ideas are in everyone's heads.
Mm-hmm.
And so when we think about the question of organization, yes, my political training from the past tells me what we need is a mass party of the working class. And let's say we're probably going to need that till we have one. But in terms of what's appropriate for the moment, I think Rhizomatic is what's been forced upon us, right? Disaggregated, localized, small groups, especially in an era when you can't gather, but with a handful of people. But there's still, I think, that's again to return to the situationists, like maybe there's a method of organization which is appropriate to the moment, and it's smaller for now.
Yeah. And I think that's the, you know, one of the best things we can do right now is try to figure out what the lessons of this moment are in terms of organizing. So if you take Occupy, for instance, one of the lessons was that it's not enough to just get together in groups of big people, and that we really have to start questioning protest culture and like just movementism, right? That you actually do have to have a larger class analysis than just the 99% and the 1%, even though that language has been very useful.
Goals.
Those huge are important. Thing. Consensus is not it, honeys.
Not even desirable, like, actually.
Yeah. Well, and then
what
in
about,
this
what
moment,
about sparkle fingers?
I can't right now. Please don't make me even think about it. At any rate, and in this moment, I think that in which we actually can't get together in large groups, and it's irresponsible even to be getting together in small groups of people that we're not actually living with, or working with. I think it's revealing that like online organizing, it has limitations, and that we've been dismissive about what's possible on the internet. But part of that has been because online organizing has been limited to just like shit posting on Twitter. And I think we're learning right now that actually like, all of these tools are things that we have to get better at using, and we haven't been – the issue isn't in and of itself getting together in large groups of people or organizing on the internet. Like, all of those things are things that we have to get better at, things that we have to develop better strategies around. than we've had. And I think this moment is really teaching us about like what it is to like use the internet and how scary it is that all of our interactions are actually being mediated by corporations now. So, you know, that doesn't get us to any conclusions other than that we have to be better.
I think, yeah, look, we should be very comfortable not having, we should become comfortable with being uncomfortable, right? Like, we don't, one thing that we have said a lot throughout the duration of the existence of this podcast is that, like, we don't have answers. And it's not just that we, as a small collection of people on a podcast, but, like, we in the broadest sense, like, anybody who thinks they know what to do because there is a star chart of world history that, you know, you can read and be like, well, the people who I most identify with as historical figures and, you know, whose legacy I like imagine I'm carrying on, they did this and so must I. The reality is nobody knows. So the more comfortable we are with that admission, the closer we might actually get to coming up with something.
Trust the people who know.
That's right. There's the tragedy of the worker editorial from Salvage, which, you know, makes a very bold claim that I think is something that should be taken up and discussed all up and down the what exists in every nascent form of resistance, whether it's person-to-person discussions or what's left of organization, is that all politics must become disaster politics.
Yes.
Like, in this era of climate change, of, you know, they talk about the sixth mass extinction, where technocratic solutions from the elite come in the form of building, essentially constructing the world that Jack London envisioned in The Iron Heel, of, like, you know, an Elysium for the rich, protected by a very well-paid militarized police force and serviced by a highly trained and efficient, you know, kind of labor aristocracy, with everybody else given a UBI and thrown out into the slums to slowly die off in pandemics. Like, that's all very real. So if disaster capitalism, if it's moving from its neoliberal form into something approximating a more visibly statist form that we might recognize as 20th century politics, but in a disaster context, our politics have to adjust to that reality as well, which means that we should stop mistaking the aesthetics of, like, post-scarcity and luxury communism as some kind of a roadmap or some kind of a vision for the future. And we should, we can return to what was essentially the very first discussion we had on this podcast, which is, like, what post-apocalyptic world do you want to live in? Right. Because is it going to be the one that they're preparing for us, or is it going to be the one that we can take from them?
We are living through the death of reality as we know it right now. And the world that we build on the other end of that can either be something that we have a say in, or something way worse than what already exists.
Right. Well, and the road that has been paved thus far is being paved in the direction of way worse.
Uh-huh.
But, you know, we are still people who, you know, have a basic, let's call it a belief in the historic mission of the proletariat. We're the ones paving the road, right? Even if the engineers and the planners have a vision, we can pave it in a different direction. But it's very sobering to have come what feels like very close to being on the kind of precipice of history. Like, it's really difficult sometimes, let's say emotionally, psychologically, probably for a lot of people. But for me, to think about how less than a month ago, I was knocking on doors, registering people to vote, going to mass rallies, you know, and channeling people in that particular direction, you know, for that moment of the presidential election. It really felt like there's energy in the air. There's something there. And to be, you know, to have that curtain drawn right as we were stepping onto the stage, it's more than demoralizing. It's like it does really drive home the point that a completely new conceptualization of how to go forward is what's demanded of us now.
To be honest, that's the position that we were always in.
Yes.
Because I don't think that they were ever going to let Sanders get the nomination, no matter what. And I still stand by that. But I think that a good would have come from the rupture that occurred by him getting cheated in plain view at the convention or something like that. But I would say that the idea that, you know, a concept that I would like to return to is the one of the Marxist Pascal's wager, right? Where we have the belief, you know, we believe in the historic mission of the proletariat, right? We believe that a better world is possible, and we believe that there is nothing else to do but fight.
Mm-hmm.
Because to just not fight would be to ignore our mission, the mission that was handed to us by history. So even if it's not possible, we don't know that it is or isn't possible. Even if it's not possible, believing and behaving as though it is what we have to do. Because if we're right and it is possible, then cool. Like, you know, we played our role. We became either the plowman or the manure for the future society. Worst case scenario is that it's not possible and we tried. You know, best case scenario is it is possible and we succeed. But if it is possible and we don't try, then we've betrayed our world historic mission. Right. That's what I meant to say.
The sphere of possibility is bounded in part, not totally, but at least in part, by beliefs about what is possible for certain. This is one of the, you know, this is one of the most, you know, this is why ideology is so important as something to understand for the left, as a terrain on which to struggle for the left. You know, there's a Marxist by the name of Göran Terborn, Swedish guy, who wrote this little book on ideology, where he basically breaks down ideology to the answer to three simple questions. One is, what exists? You know, what is? The second is, what's good or what's right? And the third is, what is possible? What is possible, what people believe to be possible, conditions that people are going to be willing to struggle for, what people are going to be willing to do in order to win or not. And so, for certain, our task is not only to ourselves maintain the belief against all odds that a better world is possible, which is absolutely a leap of faith. I mean, I kind of have come to understand it as an essentially religious conviction. That a better world is possible, but also to proselytize, also to get others to believe, to win people to the church of the better apocalypse, I guess.
Yes, the church of the better apocalypse. I dig it. I'm in. I am in.
Hey, that's a possible name for this episode, actually.
Yes. Actually, that is the name for this episode. Since
for
I'm
our
the one
new
who...
microsect.
Yes, the Church of the
Better
Apocalypse.
Details forthcoming.
The cool thing about it is that because it's a church, you just have to listen to the sermon and try to embody.
Tax exempt, baby.
You just have to try to embody it in your life. You know, you don't have to like show up to and do the reading. Although it does help if you do.
Well, yeah, I mean, and it'll be a cool church where they only have like a 10-minute homily, and the rest of it is all just liturgy, so you don't actually have to do much listening. You just have to perform the motions, and then it's over.
I was hoping it would be like 2 hours of praise and worship, and then a 2-hour sermon, and then 2 more hours of praise and worship, and then a fish fry where you sit around and talk about how to minister to your neighbors.
Dude, you're fucking triggering my PTSD right now. Shut the fuck up. Someone was asking me what was good to read the other day, and I was like, other than Salvage, like nothing.
Capital, Volume 1, and Capital, Volume 2, and most importantly, Capital.
Honestly,
volume 3.
Read the fucking Warsaw Press.
That's what's good to read.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I read the fucking Economist and the Independent and...
And the Financial Times and...
Yeah, Financial Times and fucking Forbes, actually. I read Forbes.
It's like you're just going to get better information about the world. In the bourgeois press, you kind of have to know how to read it or whatever.
But, well, right, you read it as a socialist.
So, like, someone asked me, you know, what do I read? And I'm like, I guess, like, sometimes Jacobin, sometimes not Jacobin.
I mean, honestly, I don't remember the last time I even bothered to check what it was Jacobin had to say about anything.
No, I mean, just like always, just like from day one, they've got gold nuggets scattered in with like turds, you know? I think that Jacobin used to be better because it had less of a line.
Yeah.
When it was just like anybody could contribute to it, you know, and if you're already a Marxist and you want to get a very Leninist view on a non-dogmatic yet still Leninist view on any number of different things, there's always Cosmonaut.
Yeah, Cosmonaut has some Cosmonaut. Interesting stuff.
It's a journal and pretty much anyone can contribute to it. So sometimes there's good stuff, sometimes there's bad stuff.
It's one of the projects that kind of came out of the broad orbit of the Marxist Center back when that looked like it had some momentum. Yeah, like I think it's really clear that it has been an overall turn toward the Reading Circle propaganda outlet political form. Like,
yeah, the
everyone thinks of themselves as being in the Iskra stage. You know? Right.
They might not be wrong.
It might not be wrong. In fact, look, like one of the things that Platypus has had right for this whole period is that the left is dead or is dying and needs to be killed in order for there to be a decent left. If there's going to be any chance of a real socialist movement, we have to destroy the existing left. And I remember like in 2011 thinking like, these people are off their rockers, right?
Which was also true, but...
And that's the thing, right? It's the both are true at the same time. But that reality...
What is it they say, like, from the mouths of maniacs or something?
Something like that. That's in the Bible. But yeah, like the collapse of the ISO has been a net positive for the left. I think
absolutely.
The disappearance of the RCP is, of course, has been a net positive for the left.
Oh, hell yeah.
Even the sidelining of the DSA has been, I think, you know, I know it still exists, right? But it's just like, it's no longer like this hip phenomenon that's like, I think there's a reason why they stopped posting membership numbers every month.
Numbers. Yeah, exactly.
I think that the DSA has shrunk considerably in terms of real membership. And you're counted as a member when you're up to a full year arrears and dues. So like the real actual membership of the DSA is probably way smaller. And again, I think that this is probably good. Like all of this stuff needed to come and go. This crisis as a crisis illustrates the inability of the ruling class to rule in the old way. And it doesn't yet, I think, illustrate the unwillingness of the masses to be ruled in the old way. But I think it's starting to pose very sharp questions about like, what is your life going to be? What is the life of your community going to be? You know, and so on. And a way that will force people to act somehow or another. Will force people back onto the stage in a very strong way. But what hasn't even really begun yet is the economic crisis. Like it's begun in the sense that like life is hard and is getting harder, but the recession's really only just now underway. And like it happened.
It's begun in the sense that the rug has been pulled out. We haven't hit the ground yet.
Yeah, we have only begun the free fall. And I think that like, you know, people can, it's not super important, I don't think, that people understand that that an economic crisis is a crisis of profitability of a falling rate of profit, and not because there was a pandemic, but surely the pandemic is acting as handmaiden. You know, mm-hmm. I mean, look, we've been talking about the Trump recession since he got elected because we had assumed, or at least let's say we, in the sense that a lot of people had assumed that there would be a recession, had been predicting a recession for a while because the world is still the world, right? The world is still that we live in now is still the world that we lived in that brought us the 2008 crash. And none of that has been resolved. So this current economic crisis, the one that's beginning to unfold right now, I think it'll probably be blamed on the coronavirus. But that's incidental to what it will mean in people's lives, which is to say a mass immiseration or else, you know, some kind of defiance that is made concrete and material. You know, that's the that's the world that the last period was I guess preparing us for. And I don't feel super prepared, but I guess I think we're probably in a better shape now in the aftermath of, you know, like we're not in the tiny sect phase of the American left anymore, and it looks like we're coming out the other end of the electoral boosterism phase as well. So mm-hmm. we've all been through a couple of classes now, and maybe we're not quite ready to graduate, but that's being forced upon us.
We've also, you know, the tiny sect phase was sort of happening at the same time as the activist culture phase too. They kind of were hand in hand with one another.
Yeah.
Though they're not necessarily, you know, the same thing, but like the organize Food Not Bombs and a zine kind of culture is also dead.
A lot of that will revive.
That's also a good thing.
I mean, so I think part of this crisis looks like essentially mutual aid efforts. These are not going to be necessarily like activist culture mutual aid efforts, but they're going to plug the very real institutional gaps as we've sort of like hollowed out the capacity of any sort of like state bureaucracies or state institutions to adequately respond to crises such as this. Like these kinds of mutual aid efforts are starting to step in. I think that that's not a bad thing, right? I think that that's not necessarily a, for one thing, it's not so directly kind of like, subcultural or countercultural in the way that Food Not Bombs is or was.
Right.
And sometimes you will see it. I mean, so in Madison, Wisconsin, the people organizing the mutual aid effort largely are sort of like crusty IWW folks, who like are trying to make it a really ideological kind of, thing where it's like, oh, well, this is the way things ought to be rather than relying on the state, or, you know, collective institutions, I suppose, of any sort of bureaucratic sort to take care of us, which I just think is a disastrous kind of politics.
Yeah.
But I think by and large, well, put it this way, we're in for a long crisis. It's not going to be the sort of V-shaped crisis where there's a rapid recovery on the end of a rapid plummet. This is going to wipe out, lots of small and medium sized employers in the long term. That's going to further concentrate and centralize capital into the segments of the economy, large corporations, which are some of the least dynamic, least capitalized, least innovative, and least responsible for new growth and employment. Right. So we're in for like kind of a long haul crisis, I think. And I think part of what that means is
Seems that way.
Left and the institutions of the left, part of the thing they're going to have to figure out is like delivery of direct aid to people. Particularly the sort of populations who are the most vulnerable. I mean, think about, for instance, well, this $1,200 payment, right? Is not going to anybody who doesn't have citizenship or a green card. It's not even going to people who are citizens who live in mixed status households, right? So it's going to leave out something like 17 million people. People who are sort of out of status or who are undocumented migrants. They're going to be people who are going to be extremely vulnerable, have very little capacity on their own to wage direct confrontations without undertaking like massive fucking risks. And I think aid delivery is going to be part of what the left has to contend with in the way it was in the 1920s and 30s in the South with the Communist Party organizing sharecroppers, right? This was an aspect of what it meant to recruit people. It was like, well, we're the party who put you back in your house where the party can turn your fucking water back on.
Yeah.
I think it's going to be some stuff like that as well,
yeah.
For sure.
Yeah.
Well, the other thing is that, like, we can't keep romanticizing those eras. And then, like, Black Panther's mutual aid efforts, the breakfast program, the literacy program, without actually taking a look at the things that helped them recruit successfully, which was right. not, like, depoliticizing that work. Just because you say, like, this isn't charity, this is solidarity work, doesn't actually make that true. And so, you know, who knows if it, you know, what this will actually look like in the end. But I know in terms of the mutual aid work we're doing here in Corpus, one of the things that very early on we said we were going to have to do was put out very specific demands that were specific to our location, to our industrial district, to our port, which are, you know, what our local officials have been married to and why they're twiddling their thumbs so much about putting a shelter in place, which we actually don't have yet. We have a stay-at-home order, which actually doesn't mean a hell of a lot of anything if our beaches are still open, if our international port is still open, and if all of these workers who are non-essential are essential by relationship to their or by virtue of their relationship to, like, the port or the industrial district, right? And I don't think that a lot of mutual aid work is, like, putting out propaganda in a way that isn't abrasive and says, like, we're only going to help you if you come to our Bible study, you know? But also puts what we're demanding out there and makes clear that we're doing this work because the state and the, you know, NGO industrial complex is not going to be able to fill these gaps. And that we shouldn't really have to be doing it, but we're fucking going to, right? Until we have better social services in place, until, you know, our demands are met, like, we're going to be loud. And this will go on, and this is a consistent thing here because of our history of crises, both in terms of water bans and in terms of natural disasters. Like, we're going to see lasting effects because everyone is, but especially because of the peculiarities of us locally. Like, mutual aid is a consistent part of the work we do and part of building trust in our communities, that they know we'll call the fucking socialists.
All right, so I think that one of the things that we can take away from all the topic of mutual aid is that it's necessary and it's going to fill up a lot of the gaps that are left by the, you know, receding state and the things the state should be doing, and that devoid of a larger vision and some sort of larger push on a much larger scale, like nationally or regionally or whatever, that's just going to turn into basically what it was in the 90s and the 2000s, which mm-hmm. is just
demand should also be made by the way on the local yeah. state, and because that's part of what forces crises at
bigger levels. Absolutely.
You know, it's like you deliver aid, but you also, you know, you make demands to the county or the city that they have to be stepping in. They have to be protecting people, residents. And like, you know, the cities will go bankrupt. The counties will go bankrupt. They'll go to their states and they'll go to the federal government saying, give me, need more money. It's the same, you know, it's really part of what the lessons of, mutual aid well with regard to organizing the unemployed in the 30s. It's basically the way that went was it wasn't just aid delivery. And it can't just be aid delivery. It's like you also have to be forcing these confrontations,
sure. right,
you have to
right.
be these crises. And you have to be, you know.
Well, and you have to be listening to the people that you're delivering aid to, right? Like, well, what do you need? What are your concerns right now? What are the specific, like, troubles that you're experiencing, right? And it's about us developing our analysis on next steps around those things, right? We're not there to deliver, like, goods and resources to people and also a political analysis that doesn't also include them in that process, right? So, you know, if you're not including a place on your, like, request forms or talk when you're talking to people when they're calling in for aid or emailing or however it is that you're interacting with folks, if you're not also trying to understand what their struggles are, then you're not actually developing analysis for next steps.
If people want to hear more about this, we have an hour and a half long Patreon episode about this subject. So yeah, people should go listen to that.
Oh, yeah. Well, right. And all, yeah. And again, like, I agree that all of it is ultimately just too limited if it doesn't translate into pressure to have the mutual aid networks be outdone by the state.
Yeah.
Right. That's the goal, I would think. There's obviously the immediate goal of providing relief and of giving people a sense of hope and a sense of community and togetherness, right? Those are things we need in the immediate. But the long-term goal is to be rendered obsolete as a mutual aid network.
Right.
The same way that the breakfast program, you know, like, was rendered obsolete once school started offering free breakfast.
Absolutely. Because, you know, the programs that are put in place during this period of this combined crisis, these combined crises of pandemic and economic slowdown, they're going to like redefine American life for a long time. And if there's anything that we can really look forward to on the other end, when we can gather again, you know, because I think, you know, we'll be rolling in and out of outbreak and seclusion, right? So we'll have to get really comfortable switching back and forth. But in those periods, whenever, you know, the capacity for like mass physical politics, when that becomes more possible again, a lot of our political fights are going to be defined by extending programs and by defending them, right? Like, one of the things that has kept, it seems to me, like looking back over the last few decades, one of the things that's kept Europe and the rest of the industrialized world kind of ahead of us politically is that they started that way. Or they didn't start that way, but they've been that way for a while. Because, you know, when you get a rightist administration in a country that has a national health service and, you know, strong unemployment benefits and so on, and they try to cut those things, even defensive struggles can be waged on this mass scale to defend the existing programs. We're entering into a period in which the programs worth defending might actually come into existence. So I think that that's, you know, part of any relief efforts, any stopgaps, any filling the breach that we can do in terms of, you know, basic protections for people. They have to be placed on a scale large enough to where they become fixtures to defend. And, you know, that's pretty grand and bold or whatever. And that's why I think we have to be optimists of the will, even if we're pessimists of the intellect. Like, we have to have the willpower to see that through to, you know, if there is a better world that is possible, that's part of the road there, I think.
Our pessimism must be dialectical, comrades.
Yeah.
I mean, but, you know, I think that's one of the sort of more hopeful aspects of this moment, is that all of a sudden stuff that was being, some stuff that was being demanded for a long time, often by like basically kind of fringe or marginalized movements, it turns out like someone somewhere can snap their fingers and make it happen. You know, one really kind of cool aspect of this, if you like, or like one thing that has been really good to see, is states just like emptying their prisons. Just this sort of immediate kind of falling apart of the like carceral state in some localities and some places, just saying like, no, actually, like, we're all the people who are like basically indefinitely detained waiting for trial, all the people who are like held on like parole violations or whatever, like, we're actually just gonna let you go. Like, we're just gonna let you back out. It was like, oh, you could always do that. You could have always done that. Like, you always had the ability to do that. And now everybody sees, oh, yeah, you could just always do, you know, people don't have to be in jail. You can just let them the fuck out.
Yeah.
You
can always have, like,
and you can always,
unemployment insurance.
Sure. And you can always choose which laws you're going to enforce and arrest people for, which they've also, like, arbitrarily been doing.
Well, there's, you know, they've been very careful to make it a one-time payment, $1,200 payment per person. And at a means test, right? They provided, which is, as far as means test goes, it's a relatively expansive means test. It's, I think, the $75,000 a year for
That's the Democrat contribution, right? Is the means testing.
Yeah. You also have to have paid your taxes, which yes. a number of people who are working under, you know, the yeah. radar haven't done. So they will not receive yeah, right. that.
And that, and a lot of this only is even happening because of Bernie Sanders' I guess it wasn't really a filibuster, his really long speech
yeah.
where he like took the Democratic and Republican, you know, senators to task for their fucking just for their like cold heartedness yeah. about what they were yeah. willing to dole
and
out.
So it's, these hopefully, I mean, they certainly have the potential to be sticky, right? Where it's like it raises people's expectations as to what's possible, what can be done, and what kind of standard of living they ought to have and have a right to. That was the content of the Republican opposition to expansion of unemployment insurance, that extra $600 a week. Yeah, that was right. The opposition was like, no, you're going to raise the standard too high. If we're paying people more to stay home than to work, they're going to expect higher wages, you know, when this is all over. And that's, for us, that's a feature, not a bug, right? Of those kinds of policies.
Right.
I think the kind of policy now that's having a bit of a moment in the sun is universal basic income, which, you know, this time, or, you know, whatever, 2 months ago, was actually just pure fucking pipe dream, like just something that like maybe policy wonks would talk about at cocktail parties because it was like a fun topic. But now it's yeah. like several well, European countries have essentially instituted a UBI-like program for the duration. Canada has committed to $2,000 a month for 4 months or 5 months or something like that. And it's exactly the kind of thing that once people are accustomed to having a guaranteed income, they will prefer their life with it than without it. And it'll emerge as a really kind of, not only a popular demand, but something that's seen as eminently practicable and doable because we've been doing it now, as a result of this crisis response. I don't know if y'all have had an episode ever on basic income. At some time, it's like both this sort of well-liked policy on the left and also reviled policy on the left. But it's emerging.
It's because yeah. it's good and bad.
It's only just it's because it is both good and bad, right? It's like people.
Yeah,
you know,
said that.
Yeah, I'm agreeing with you. Because.
Just want to echo what the comrade.
Piggybacking off of what the comrade said.
Because
it's both good and bad.
Because by itself, it if the worst part about it is that it removes, or it helps enshrine, a detachment from people, and their role in society as workers, and thus of their capacity to act as such. And on the other hand, it's good because it, like, you know, people
don't starve.
People don't starve. Right. Which is, it's just to say that, like, it's by itself, it's just not enough. It's one of those things that has to be presented as part of a broader overall, like an overhauling of multiple aspects, systemic change. Right. But like, yeah, it's definitely something that we need. Right. It's definitely something we should be at. We should be, you know, to the extent that we have any growing capacity that we should be demanding. It's just that it can't be seen as like, that's how we respond to the new economy.
Yeah, right. So, but,
right.
Right.
That's the liberal technocratic vision. We still have to destroy the new economy.
I mean, here's the thing about it though, right? Is that it's emerging as a central policy response to the crisis currently.
Yeah.
And that's going to be the world that we're operating in. And our demands are going to have to take into account that fact. And so it's now, you know, all of a sudden, put it this way, all of a sudden the questions become less academic. And so it's interesting. It's maybe, it's unfortunate that, in some ways that it's been that policy response rather than say, making sure everybody has access to healthcare. But so far that's not the response. Mm-hmm. No, so far that isn't the policy response, is some kind of universalization of access to care. The needle hasn't moved on universal access to healthcare in the United States, even with the coronavirus. In the sense of, there's been no serious policy proposal from any quarter.
Right.
Or like I think nationalizing it's fucking hospitals or the whole healthcare right. industry.
That has happened in Spain.
Yeah.
I think that it's still split half and half as far as whether or not people think we need universal, you know, Medicare for all.
Yeah.
It's still an even split, but we'll see how that looks once this
but
coronavirus
even
starts
Medicare
to peak.
For all would be insufficient now because the issue is that hospitals are privately owned and operated for the most part.
That's true.
And
yeah.
it's really showing capitalism's ass in a number of ways. So, you know, I mean,
capitalism does not have a nice ass.
It sure don't. But I guess more than that, what I wanted to speak to was kind of
more than capitalism's ass.
Certainly. Which I do think that we should talk about, like, what, you know, nationalizing the healthcare industry would mean and what it would look like and how easy seemingly it's been for places like Spain to just do that overnight. And make the decision to just like, okay, yeah, well, this is how it is now. Sorry to all you know, whatever. It is, I guess I wanted to kind of revisit what Michael was saying about like what law enforcement and decarceration has looked like right now, and how revealing it's been in terms of like both what they're choosing to enforce and not enforce, and in the midst of these like this weird draconian period of time in which they're enforcing things like shelter in place and lockdown and stuff like that, and what that's looked like, you know, and it's been different everywhere, right? But also what that's meant that like 500 NYPD officers tested positive for coronavirus, which is really easy to like giggle about and feel good about, right? But then I also have to question, like, well, how many people were they in contact with? And why are they considered fucking essential labor? So they're going around getting infected and infecting probably primarily Black and Brown communities who will not be tested.
Yeah, dude, that's like easily 5,000 people that will be infected by those 500 cops. That's not it's not funny. It's
yeah, and we likely won't know because, you know, they aren't afforded the same privileges as NYPD, right? So, you know, it really calls into question, why the fuck were they essential? Why were there so many cops just roaming around, like, fucking with people? Like, you know,
they demonstrated that they weren't essential whenever they went on strike, remember? Yeah. And crime fucking didn't rise?
Yeah. Yeah. So, I mean, there are a lot of things that are just really, you know, it's hard to feel good about being right now.
It's hard to feel good about anything right now.
You're not wrong, sister.
Honestly, I like always feel so bad that right now I just kind of feel normal.
Right.
Like, not a joke.
Yeah.
Everybody's just a little more on your level, Chris. Actually, so it's like maybe you feel a little less lonely.
Yeah,
I'm like, you know, I'm always so depressed about how shitty everything is and my prospects in the world, and like, now everybody is fucking feeling really shitty, and I'm like, oh, hey, I just kind of feel normal. Sorry, guys. I'm okay.
Yeah, I think that dimension of the present crisis is just, like, staggering and impossible to get our heads around. It's, like, the emotional, psychological trauma that it is for people mm-hmm. to worry about, you know, catching an illness that will kill them. Or else
for people that haven't been expecting the apocalypse imminently for the past few years anyway.
Yeah.
Right. And to think that everything is okay and to all of a sudden have the rug yanked out from underneath them.
Right. Well, and to be faced with a choice between being in contact with a deadly virus
and having an income,
and having an income, which means the choice between, you know, risking your life at work versus risking your life living on the streets.
Right.
And for a lot of people, that also means, you know, your children or your extended family, your parents, whatever. And there isn't something for that right now.
Nope.
Like, the best mutual aid network in the world can keep us together physically while we wait it out. But the kind of meaning that people can derive in life from participation in history, that that horizon appears to have been to have disappeared for now. And the big existential question is like how to weather that storm, you know, as individuals, but also in the way that we relate to one another, you know. And we hear a lot of stuff about like, you know, and this is true, right? I agree with this broadly. Like, yeah, have Zoom calls with your friends, you know, call your parents, start playing online games, like whatever it is that you can do to stay in touch with people. But I wonder a lot about like in the aftermath of this, what are human relations going to be like? And what kind of an effect will that have on our capacity collectively to do things, like necessary things, even things that history compels us to do? I don't know. Sometimes it's staggering, you know, In the broadest and most abstract sense, I think like our, you know, one of our great tasks is just to like live beautifully enough to within the confines of the moment to, if not thrive, then at least maintain until new possibilities arrive. But like that's a tall order. And it means in the granular details that it doesn't, there's nothing there. You have to basically invent it yourself. I don't even know what to say about it other than just that I think that that's a thing to acknowledge and to really contemplate.
We got to keep posting, man.
Got to keep on posting.
Keep posting no matter what.
Right? Like part of our obligation to the world, in as much as we actually think that we represent something, is to keep alive a vision of a world that is infinitely more worthy of our existence, worth living in, you know. Like now is a time when it's not just that we're potentially coming up against some of our last chances to live, right? But also our last chances to have a excuse for having lived in the first place. A generation, these things will define us in ways that I think we just will never fully know until after, like, we'll be gone before it's really clear what it means for the world in terms of what we did during this period.
Get no supper tonight. A lot of people won't get no justice tonight. And the battle is getting hard in this Irish Armageddon tonight. A lot of people won't get no justice tonight. Remember to kick it off. No one will guide you long in time. Ooh. Ooh.
lot of people. A lot of people wanna get known. I stop with some night. A lot of people sitting down by the light. A lot of people wanna get known. I stop with some night. A lot of people wanna get known. Adjust this tonight.